Welcome to the Blue Side Podcast, brought to you by Cambridge University Science Magazine. In each episode, we delve into the intersections between science, technology and society, featuring guest researchers who present a fresh perspective on their work, what goes on behind the scenes, and the latest developments in their field.
The Blue Side Podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, who supply laboratory, diagnostic, and medical products to research institutions, higher education, the NHS, and others across the UK. For details of their full product range, visit www.gbo.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Blue Side Podcast. Today, Simone and I spoke to Lauren, a postdoctoral researcher at the Yusuf Hamid Department of Chemistry at the University of Cambridge. Here, she focuses on understanding the impact that large magnitude volcanic eruptions have on the Earth's climate through the use of climate models and the study of ice cores. Lauren has a background in Earth sciences and physical geography and has previously completed an MSc in Applied Meteorology and Climatology. Her research is helping to improve knowledge of how the different components of an explosive volcanic eruption may affect the climate response, improving the understanding of past and future climate.
So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Marshall. It's really nice to have you here. Could you start us off maybe by telling us a bit more about what you're working on currently?
Sure. Hi. Well, thanks for having me here. So I look at how volcanic eruptions impact the atmosphere and the climate. I am a climate modeller, and I really focus on the impact of large explosive eruptions that emit a lot of gas high up into the atmosphere. I work on trying to understand how eruptions in the past, for example, over the last 2,000 years, may have affected the climate, and also how hypothetical eruptions may impact the climate in the future. And then as part of this, we also look at things like the impact on atmospheric chemistry, on the environment, and also on society, as well as that climate impact.
Cool, very cool. So how do the models that you're using to predict these things work? How do you build them? What kind of data do you have to use to actually construct them?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So I use complex global climate models, which we run on supercomputers. So these have been developed over many years, if not decades. And so they're based on physical equations, so equations that govern the movement of energy and mass throughout the Earth system. And these equations are then translated into computer code. So the whole Earth is split into different grid boxes, and then these equations are solved. And so it's really a collaborative effort. So as the science moves on, as people find out different things, they might add new processes into that model. And specifically for what I do, that might be improving or adding chemical equations that describe some of the processes that happen after a volcanic eruption. For example, how sulfur dioxide is converted into aerosol, and I'm sure we'll come back to this. And once you have that model output, you have a simulation, you can then evaluate that against observations. And so if the simulated climate, for example, looks good compared to the observations, then you can make some statements on how good that model is, or you might find that you need to add an additional process. So it's a kind of an iterative thing that goes along, and then you have this super model that lots of people use and develop over time.
How do you verify these models?
Yeah, so a lot is done with comparing to observations. And for climate, you know, you would simulate the climate and you would look at how that compares to what is happening. That could be modern day observations, so things like satellite observations, or if you're looking in the past, you might use other methods of reconstructions of climate. And we have a lot of information from things like tree rings, for example, that demonstrate cooling in the past. And this can be used to compare to the model. So that's a good way of looking into it, I guess.
Okay, so I guess from this, you can, like, what have you actually learned about how volcanic eruptions have affected the climate? Are they kind of local effects or are they global effects? Are there differences in how the response is in different places?
Yeah, so eruptions are one of the most important natural drivers of climate change. And during a large eruption, a lot of material is injected into the atmosphere. So this will include things like volcanic ash, rock, and gas. So, for example, carbon dioxide, or water vapor, but the most important gas for the climate impact is actually sulfur dioxide. And this is because that sulfur dioxide gets oxidized in the atmosphere and goes on to form tiny little aerosol particles known as sulfate aerosol. These are about 0.2 microns in size, so they're very small, and they scatter solar radiation away from the planet which actually causes a cooling effect. So this is something we can then directly simulate in the models. And so if you look at temperature over the last 100 years or so, you'll see a long-term warming trend because of human-caused climate change. But then there are short-term cooling episodes caused by large eruptions, and that cooling typically lasts around a couple of years. And this depends on a lot of aspects of the eruption. For example, the amount of sulfur dioxide that is emitted, the latitude of the volcano, also the height of the emissions. And so whether these are local or global effects also then depends on those properties. For example, if the eruption has a global impact, the sulfur dioxide usually needs to be injected into the stratosphere. So the lowest level of our atmosphere is known as the troposphere. That's where our weather occurs. That's where airplanes fly in, for example. But the next layer up, this is around about 15 kilometers, is known as the stratosphere. And if aerosol gets in the stratosphere, it can be transported globally if it's introduced in the tropical regions. And so in that sense, that eruption could have a potential global impact. But if the aerosol is just either in one hemisphere, it might be deposited sooner and won't necessarily have a global impact. And if the aerosol is not even introduced into the stratosphere, so it stays in the troposphere where the weather is, it doesn't have a long lifetime. And so it's more likely to have a local impact and also a shorter impact. So on the scale of weeks to months, not years.
So often when you hear about climate change, we hear about like greenhouse gases and so on, global warming, but I guess the historical impact of volcanoes and volcanic eruptions isn't something that necessarily, you know, on a day-to-day basis we think about. So I was wondering, in terms of the history of the planet Earth and the role that volcanoes have played in kind of shaping how we got to the climate that we have now, or have they been like the most significant players, I guess, in shaping the Earth's climate up to where we got to so far, or?
That's a really interesting question, and it really depends on what timescale you're talking about. So on really long geological timescales, say thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, actually the emission of carbon dioxide from the volcanoes can become important in terms of the warming effect that we all know about from CO2. But if you're looking, say, for example, the last 2,000 years, and this is a period that I've worked on quite a lot, then the variability in that climate before we get to human-caused climate change is dominated by volcanic eruptions. So you'll have the trend as you go along in a kind of variable temperature over time, and then you'll have these sharp periods of cooling caused by eruptions. And so they contribute most of the variability in climate without that kind of human influence. And so it's important we understand how volcanoes impact the climate, because that also tells us about how other things might impact the climate. So if you have a temperature trend and you know how volcanoes have impacted that, then you can start to also understand how other things impacted that, whether that's changes in the solar cycle, for example, or it's changes because of human causes. So it's good to know all the factors that are in play in changing the climate.
What is the overarching aim of carrying out these models? Is it to understand how these affect the climate individually?
So I think there's probably two areas. Firstly, in terms of potentially predicting the impact in the future. So I do a lot of work on hypothetical eruptions and what they might do, so that we might have an idea of those climate effects. We might also have an idea of some of those environmental effects. You know, for example, cooling will lead to changes to precipitation that might also lead changes to crops, for example, and that can put a lot of pressure on society. So it's important that we kind of understand we might be able to mitigate or adapt to some of those things. And then the other thing is in terms of understanding more about our climate system in general. So you learn a lot about the climate from studying volcanic eruptions. You can learn about how they might impact atmospheric chemistry, how they might impact dynamics in the atmosphere, so things like the winds and where they move. And that then allows us to learn more about the chemistry and the physics in general, not necessarily just related to volcanoes, but the makeup of the atmosphere and how it works.
So what kind of factors are likely to make a volcanic eruption have a bigger impact than others, or, you know, a smaller impact alternatively?
So one of the biggest impacts is the amount of sulfur dioxide emitted by an eruption. So if you have more sulfur dioxide, you tend to form more aerosol, you're going to reflect or scatter more sunlight, so you're going to have a bigger cooling. There are some interesting self-limiting effects, actually, that as you form more aerosol, and the aerosol particles actually coagulate, they come together, and more sulfuric acid vapor that is formed after the sulfur dioxide is oxidized can condense onto that aerosol and form larger aerosol particles. And larger aerosol particles are actually less efficient at scattering solar radiation. Because they're larger, they also fall out of the atmosphere more quickly. So this means that as you kind of have a progressively larger emission, you'll still have a stronger climate impact, but it's not linear. It will tail off at that upper end. That's one contributing factor. Another one is the latitude. And I kind of alluded to this before, but if you have an eruption at the tropics and it gets into the stratosphere, there is this circulation in the stratosphere that moves material from the tropics to the poles and then descent over the poles. So that gives you a global coverage and the aerosol lasts for longer. It could be on the order of a few years. Whereas if it's a high latitude eruption, let's say Iceland, for example, that aerosol is going to predominantly stay in the northern hemisphere. It's not going to last as long. It's not going to have such a large impact. And then we have that impact of injection height, whether it gets into the troposphere, where it won't last as long, or the stratosphere. And there are some interesting features in the stratosphere that actually mean the specific injection height within the stratosphere can impact the response. So there's a lot of factors and properties of that eruption that can then dictate the magnitude of that cooling.
So when you're putting all this data into your models, where does the data actually come from? Like, how do we actually measure, you know, this amount of sulfur dioxide that we have in the atmosphere? How do we quantify a volcanic eruption?
Yeah, so for eruptions during the satellite era, we have a lot of these measurements. So that since around 1979, we've got satellite measurements of SO2 from these eruptions. You can also get SO2 from balloon measurements, perhaps also an aircraft, or also ground-based measurements such as LIDAR. So we have a pretty good idea of what the emissions were for eruptions in the recent observational period. There are still some uncertainties, but for eruptions in the past, this is when it's a little more tricky. And one way that we can kind of infer these emissions when we haven't got observations is either from looking at eruption deposits, and you can look at the rock and the composition and you can infer what the emissions may have been, or the other way is by looking at sulfur or sulfate measured in ice cores. So this is because that aerosol is transported globally, let's say it was a tropical eruption, and will be eventually deposited to the surface, some of which will be deposited over Greenland and Antarctica. And if you then take an ice core and you have layers in the ice, you might find a distinct volcanic layer that you can actually see that might be ash. It'll be very visible. And so that's a marker that an eruption has occurred, and you can date that. And then you also might be able to detect a sulfur spike. And then that's indicative of an eruption if it's above kind of background levels. And so this is one of the main ways that we find out about the SO2 emissions of past eruptions, is by taking ice cores, measuring that sulfate, and then the larger that sulfur signal, you can infer the amount of sulfur that was potentially in the atmosphere. Again, there's a lot of uncertainties because the amount of sulfur deposited is also going to be a function of where the volcano was located latitudinally. And for many of these eruptions in the past, we have no idea what volcanoes were actually responsible. We might know an eruption has occurred because we might see a signal in the ice cores, or we might see a signal in proxy records of climate change. So through tree rings, there might be a cooling spike. So we think, okay, eruption may have occurred, but we don't know where it is. So we have to also factor in the latitude, whether the aerosol was spread to both hemispheres, or maybe there were two simultaneous eruptions that led to a signal in both Antarctica and Greenland. Or if there's just one signal, then perhaps that eruption was just in the Northern Hemisphere, for example, if the signal was in Greenland.
I mean, it sounds like a very complex kind of situation to be in, where you're trying to figure out what happened in the past, but you only have kind of the physical data that we have today that we can find out, you know, if we look at these rocks or we look at these deposits or these ice cores. It sounds quite fascinating. And I guess it sounds like it's quite an interdisciplinary question to be asking as well. You must have to work not just with other modelists, but also with geologists, volcanologists, people working in forests, people working on satellites. Like, it sounds like quite a lot of different disciplines are involved. How is that working in that kind of atmosphere?
Yeah, definitely. It's really good, I think, to be involved in a lot of collaborations like this. And I think that's actually what's really cool about some of this research is that I'm predominantly focused on modeling, but we need to get the SO2 emissions from the geologists or the satellite specialists. So if an eruption was to occur, for example, the emissions would come from them and we could then feed it into the model and see what happens. And there's some really nice interdisciplinary studies, not just with scientists, but also with historians who, for example, might look through historical records and there could be some indication that an eruption occurred because there were poor harvests. And there's some nice examples after, for example, there was a big eruption in 1257, Samalas, that led to a really delayed grape harvest because of the cooling. And that's actually in historical records, I believe. And so you can kind of link up some of these things. And actually, some eruptions in the past have been attributed to specific volcanoes through combined evidence from modelling, from measurements, whether that's from tree rings, from other climate proxies, and then from historical records. So yeah, it's a nice field to be working in, to have all these different areas come together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So for you, what is the most exciting aspect of all the work that you do? Is there anything in particular, or is it kind of everything?
I think volcanoes are generally cool. I mean, I'm definitely still in awe of them. And a lot of my work has looked at hypothetical eruptions. So in this sense, we can play with the climate through the model, which I think is really exciting. You know, we can say, well, what if an eruption occurs here? Or what if it has this emission? Or what if it occurs in January or not July? And I think that's really exciting to have that ability to explore these things. And then to be able to learn much more about the climate, and obviously that becomes more important looking forward. It's important that we have correct projections of climate, not correct, but we have an idea of what might happen. And then it's important that we then consider, well, what is the imprint of volcanic eruptions onto this? How do those two things interact? So it's a very exciting interface to be a part of.
And I guess you were saying that since the 70s, you now have access to satellite data. And obviously there's a lot more, not necessarily accurate data, but more specific information that you've gathered specifically for this purpose. Well, not you, but in general, the community that works on this. And I was wondering, do you think that's changed the way that the field has grown, do you think, since then, now that you have access to more data? Or like in recent years, since we have more and more information coming in and more computational capacity as well to run models, has our understanding of the climate improved a lot recently?
Absolutely. I mean, so especially with increased computational power, we can run really complex simulations of these volcanic eruptions. And so we can really simulate the whole life cycle from an initial SO2 emission. And we can really constrain that if we've got good observations. So we can have a much better chance of predicting that climate impact. We include more processes, so we can get a better idea of how it might impact atmospheric chemistry and then surface climate. 20 years ago, that would have been very difficult to run these kind of simulations. They're very expensive, both in terms of time and also computational cost. So as we improve the models as well, this will also get better. Then we can run thousands of simulations and try and understand what might happen. And in terms of increased observations and better proxy record, this only helps in us being able to understand what really happened. There's so much uncertainty in terms of the magnitude of the climatic impact from eruptions in the past because we don't have those records. And so by better constraining that, we get a much better idea, improving those ice core records, getting more tree ring records, examples like that.
So obviously you mentioned, you know, like now you've got satellites, you've got supercomputers to do this. But obviously, where do you feel like this field's going to go from in the future?
I think we have a really good grasp on the overall global impact of these eruptions, but there are a lot of uncertainties remaining in some of the regional aspects. And a lot of this can be limited by, for example, if we're simulating the effects, the size of the grid boxes in the model, the way that the Earth is split up. So in the model that I use, a grid box represents 100 kilometers. So you can't explicitly simulate everything that happens less than that scale. You have to parameterize it. So there's uncertainties related to that, and that will improve as models improve. And in terms of scientific questions, a lot of uncertainties remaining in terms of what's the impact on hydroclimate, for example. That's a smaller scale process. impacts on specific circulations in ocean atmosphere, such as ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation. There's a lot of uncertainty around, do eruptions impact it or don't they, and what's the mechanism? And another example of an open question is, what's the impact of multiple eruptions that occur very close together in time? So if you had three eruptions in a small time period, could this actually cause a long-term cooling impact? Eruptions have been implicated as contributing to the Little Ice Age, but we're still not exactly sure about some of these feedbacks and how long these effects could be sustained. So yeah, some interesting questions still to be answered there.
Do you also work on eruptions that happen like right now? So for example, there's recently been this eruption in La Palma in Spain. Whenever there's a volcanic eruption, do you get like a little alert, like take the data, run the model, see what's going to happen? Or how does that work? How does the balance between now and, yeah?
No, it does work like that. So there's some national and international groups, for example, mailing lists and the like, that this information will come out straight away. So as soon as an eruption occurs, scientists will be alerted to the amount of SO2 that's emitted, and then they can run a simulation straight away. In terms of the eruptions that I deal with, these are large explosive eruptions that inject on the order of 10 teragrams of sulfur dioxide or more. This is what I tend to focus on. And the last eruption to have occurred of that size was the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo. So there hasn't actually been a big, really climate relevant eruption for over 30 years. Of course, there's been a lot of other small magnitude eruptions, and they still have a climate impact, but not as great as the ones that I'm used to dealing with. And so if an eruption was to occur tomorrow, there are plans in place to make sure that we get new observations, to make sure that we monitor it and things like that.
Okay, that's really interesting. So kind of what inspired you to pick this up move into this field?
I've always been interested in earth sciences and physical geography and things like that. But it wasn't really until my undergraduate degree that I really came across more of the climate science side of things. And then it really took off from there. So I was fortunate to find a PhD project that was looking at volcanoes and climate. I actually did a master's in meteorology. So the PhD then brought together my background in earth sciences and meteorology, and was just really cool. And it's continued from there.
Have you ever like actually visited a volcano? Do you get to do that? Or I guess if you're a modelist, do you mainly work behind a computer or?
Unfortunately, yes, it's all behind the computer for most of the things I do. So I haven't actually been able to get into the field. I mean, that's something I would love to do in the future, perhaps moving towards monitoring the emissions and measuring an aerosol and things like that. I've been fortunate to visit a few through conferences. So that's been really good. But no, just simulating them on the computer.
So you're now a postdoctoral researcher. So we kind of talked about what inspired you to end up working at volcanoes. You said you maybe want to visit a volcano. Would you like your research to kind of focus on in the future? What do you think is like the most exciting question that you'd really like to see solved in your career?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, I would love to continue this research. I would really like to see some more of these unknown eruptions constrained. So we talked about past 2000 years, a lot of those signals that we see in ice cores, we don't know what those eruptions were. We don't know. So it's very difficult to simulate them in that sense, because we might have an estimate of what the SO2 emission, but we just don't know what the latitude was. We don't know where it comes from. And I think as more records come out and there's more modeling studies that explore the role of different parameters, so that's things like the latitudes, the height, the SO2 emission, we might be able to find out more about what these eruptions were. And then we'll get a much better idea of how the climate was changed by volcanoes. So I think that's really exciting and something that I would like to pursue in the future.
So recently, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded half jointly to Sikuro Manabe and Klaus Hasselmann for their work on climate modeling. And I was wondering if you, as someone working in climate modeling, I don't know if they specifically also worked on volcanoes, but what does this Nobel Prize kind of mean for the field? Do you think it's the kind of recognition that the field has been waiting for a long time? Or do you think that it reflects kind of a new sentiment of the importance of global warming? I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think it's really great that climate change is getting this recognition. This increases the publicity and hopefully, you know, means more people are aware and aids us in doing something about it. That's only a good thing.
Thank you very much for coming along today. It's been really fascinating learning a bit more about your research and everything, and you know, learning more about the climate. And hopefully we've just inspired the listeners to this podcast that maybe they should learn more about this sort of area of research, because it's fascinating, frankly.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been great to talk to you both.
Is there somewhere that people can get to know more about your research? Do you have a website or anything you want to plug?
I don't have a website, but this is maybe something that I should do. You can find me on my Cambridge webpage and things like that. So.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did recording it. We would love to hear what you thought of this week's episode. You can get in touch via Twitter on @BlueSciPod or by email at podcast@bluesci.co.uk. To keep updated with our new episodes, you can subscribe to the podcast on Anchor or whatever platform you use.